In the news.
Good morning, I'm Professor Shaw.
And I'm Professor McDaniel. Welcome to In the News for American and Texas Politics.
You got that creamy mint going right there?
That's right.
Yeah, got early breath mints. We're focusing on Prince Thursday. It's a little purple for all of you. And we're also discussing whether it's cost effective to go with the unlimited data plan associated with text messages. Verizon is informing me by the minute that I'm going over and I owe them more money. And so it's like a running tally. It's like one of those billboards talk about the national debt. So Professor McDaniel recently switched to unlimited and he's only got one child. So I don't know about that.
Oh, she gets no phone until I told her 14 straight A's. That ain't happening.
That's good. I think it ought to be we got a thing with, my kids are in Boy Scouts, my boys, and some of the parents say you have to get Eagle Scout before you get a car, which is a substantial incentive to become an Eagle Scout. I'm not sure that sort of incentive structure is probably the way it ought to be working, but, you know, hey, whatever gets you through the night. All right, so we are in the home stretch. The second of three midterms was this week, so congratulations to all of you for getting this far in the class. We hope things are going well. Please come to office hours if you have any questions or just want to stop by and humanize us. We like to be humanized. This week, we're going to talk about a couple of things. We're going to really focus on the national because most of the action has been going on at the national level this week. And once again, we're trying to, you know, connect some of the things that are in the news with points raised in the class. Some of them are a little distant. You know, when we talk about federalism, we've already talked about that, you know, quite a bit ago, I guess. But also things we're talking about in the modules in the coming weeks would be elections and campaigns and public opinion. So we're trying to connect up to things past and present that we've been doing in the class. And we're going to start with a substantial debate, policy debate that's been going on. Well, I don't know if it's a debate so much as the Republicans trying to craft a bill that will repeal and replace Obamacare. Right. And so the news this week, as you all know from your modules and our discussion of the Senate leadership structure, Mitch McConnell is the majority leader for the Republicans in the Senate, and he is trying to shepherd the Senate's version of the, what do they call it, the American Health Act, I think, the AHA, something like that.
American Health Care Act.
American Health Care Act. So, which is different from the Affordable Care Act, more popularly known as Obamacare. So the Affordable Care Act is Obamacare, the American Health Care Act.
I guess that's Trump Care or McConnell Care.
Of America. Yeah. So that's the Senate replacement bill. Now, we just wanted to point out, because we're trying to shepherd ourselves through this as much as you guys, there is a House version. The House has already passed a bill. That was a couple weeks ago. The Senate is passing its version of the bill, and they haven't done it yet. They had to postpone a vote because the Republican majority in the Senate is 52 or 53 Republicans in the Senate right now. I think it's 53. Mm-hmm. They also have, because they control the White House, if it's a 50-50 vote, then the Vice President Pence can break it. So, you know, effectively, really, they need to get 50. That's all they need. But they've lost far more than three people on this version of the Senate bill. So, and the weird thing is that opposition is coming from both sort of moderate Republicans like Susan Collins of Maine. It's also coming from libertarian or right-wing Republicans like Rand Paul from Kentucky has said, you know, he doesn't like it at all. He thinks they ought to just basically, he doesn't think there should be any kind of government health care plan. Ted Cruz has said, you know, that it's not cost neutral enough, it's going to blow up the deficit. And, you know, so this is a tricky balancing act that McConnell has. He has to get a bill passed. And we also want to point out that Senate bill isn't what's going to go into law, even if they pass it anyway. There has to be a reconciliation between the House bill and whatever bill the Senate passes, if they pass a bill, right? So just in terms of process, we wanted to get you guys kind of engaged and involved in this because it's an example of a very complex system. So not only do you have federalism, you know, so what do the states do if and when the federal government passes something? Not only do you have checks and balances, so the president has to sign off on this at some point if there's something passed, but you have the House and the Senate within the legislative branch, and then within the Senate, you've got all these coalitional issues. And so, you know, if you're out there and you know, you like gridlock and you don't really want this administration or this Republicans to pass something. You're probably a big fan of checks and balances and federalism and party politics right now. If you're, with the president, you want reforms to the Affordable Care Act, maybe you're not so happy. But the system, as Professor McDaniel and I have been repeating throughout the semester, it's designed to make it very difficult to pass things. I mean, you gotta really want something in the American system and be pretty skilled to get something through. And looking back, you kind of have a lot of, admiration for the chutzpah of the Democrats to get the Affordable Care Act passed in the first place. That wasn't easy either.
No, it was not.
Yeah, and now the Republicans are finding out how difficult it is.
I think what you're pointing out here is extremely important, that when we understand any passage of policy, there are multiple veto points. While we think about the president and his veto as being the one place where something dies, actually, no, most bills die in committee. So things go and never make it out of committee. They have to make it out of subcommittee, make it a committee. Then they get a floor vote at the House. Then it goes to the Senate, where it goes to committee, could die there. Then the Senate votes on it, it could die there. Then you have the joint session where you have to reconcile it at the House. And if the House just hates the reconciliation, it could die there. The Senate hates how it's changed, it could die there. And then, it can go to the president, where the president could veto it. And so there's a lot of work that goes into this. And so it's very important to be aware of when we're talking about why it's so difficult for, a bill to get passed, is because the system is set up in such a way that it's really an uphill climb. And there are so many veto points, so many places where it just won't end. So think of it like Game of Thrones. If you live this long, you're doing pretty good. But it doesn't mean you're still going to live, all right? And so the whole I'm just a bill, it's very nice and sweet, but Lord have mercy, it is very naive in terms of all the things it has to do.
A couple of points. One is, when Professor McDaniel says veto points, the president has a formal veto, the institution of the veto. But if you think of veto points as just being points at which players can stop the process, that's what we mean by veto points. So there's the president has a formal veto, but informally there are all these other players who have the opportunity, and we call these veto points, to kind of stop public policy processes. The second observation is on Game of Thrones. I really think that, what's her name, the blonde dragon queen? She's a lousy ruler. I'm sorry. She's talented. I was rooting for her around season two or three. Now, not so much.
She's going to overplay her hand, because each season she gets stronger and stronger. And one thing we've known in Game of Thrones is, the stronger you get, the more likely you're going to get lopped off.
Yeah. I also thought the dragons in the arena at the end of season five, they were defeated far too easily by just some dudes. We'll probably do an original podcast on that later on the semester. All right. We also wanted to just mention that with respect to the healthcare plan, something that's been kind of in the back of everybody's minds all along, people who've been observing the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, a lot of the advocates of it kind of had a premise going in. They thought, once you put it out there, once it's in play, it's going to be very difficult to take away from people. And I think that's what you're seeing in the public opinion data right now. I'm involved with the Fox News poll, and we just had a survey out yesterday that showed, for the first time, there's been about a 10 to 12 point increase in support for the Affordable Care Act, for Obamacare, since it was initially implemented. It's a significant increase in support. Now, it's not overwhelmingly popular, but its support for Obamacare has crept up above 50% for the first time that I remember. That's significant. And I think what you're seeing is that, some of the people who have benefited, who have insurance, who didn't have insurance, they like it. Other people aren't necessarily so opposed, and they're also not really sure what the Republicans are doing. And that has become kind of a reason that the Senate version, the Senate bill, which I don't think anybody really knows much about. I mean, I've read some articles, Professor McDaniel's read some articles, we know a little bit about it, but it's not entirely clear what it'll do. The Congressional Budget Office just scored it and said it's going to reduce the deficit significantly, but it's also going to leave 22 million Americans who got health care, I shouldn't say health care, that's wrong, health insurance under Obamacare will no longer be covered. Now, that's a complicated, not to get too much into the weeds here, that's a complicated number, because what Obamacare did was it extended Medicaid coverage to people who had previously not been able to get it. So a lot of lower income people, because Medicaid at its origin point is sort of for the elderly, for the indigent and the elderly, to provide them with health insurance. But what's happened over time is that we've expanded Medicaid to cover other people who we think, you know, ought to get government assistance to support themselves for healthcare, to qualify for healthcare. So Obamacare extended that, and in order to pay for it, Obamacare insisted that certain other people who didn't have to get covered also purchase coverage. So that's why it's not quite revenue neutral, but it's close, because a bunch of people your age who tend not to purchase health insurance because it's expensive and you don't really need it, you all have to do that under Obamacare. You either purchase it or you pay a fine. And that, you know, the fact that insurance companies make money off of you guys, because you guys pay a lot of money and you don't actually get sick, right? That allows them to absorb these other people who are now getting health insurance who, you know, are probably going to use it, right? That's what's happened. And in fact, of the 22 million, some appreciable portion of that group has health insurance because they're required to by law under Obamacare. So it's complicated. That's not to be pro or con. It's just to explain why, you know, the 22 million, it doesn't necessarily mean that 22 million people who were, you know, in poverty and couldn't get health care now have health insurance and the Republicans are going to cut them off. Actually, some portion of that number are relatively healthy. They've been told by the government, y'all have to get health insurance now. And they're paying into the pool, so, you know, as a whole, it doesn't sink the system. The problem, of course, is not as many healthy people have signed up as the government thought and would sign up, and that's produced some revenue problems. And so you're seeing some insurance companies pulling out of the markets in different states. So it's complicated, but public opinion now is slightly favorable to Obamacare, probably because some people have gotten the entitlement, and other people look at the Senate version of the plan of repeal and replacement going, I don't think that's a particularly good solution. So right now, the Senate bill is very unpopular. Obamacare is marginally popular, and, you know, it's sort of an instance of the devil you know.
Yeah, and one of the key things about why the mandate exists is it's when we talk about health insurance, it's all about pooling risk. And what you want to do is you want to have a bunch of healthy people there to help subsidize the very unhealthy people. Because the problem is if the only people who have insurance are the very unhealthy people, that means they're using all the resources and you basically go into a death spiral and financially in the sense that they're just using all the resources. You need some people there who won't be using the resources as much. And we think about pooling risk. This is what we see in a lot of things. So think of car insurance. Also, when they mortgage loans or they bundle the loans, you know, we have some that are high risk, but they have a lot that are safe. You know, we try to bundle risk. We try to hide risk in a variety of ways. And again, as Professor Shaw pointed out, one of the biggest problems of the mandate is that it wasn't strong enough to get healthy people to purchase insurance to help offset the cost. And again, there are a bunch of documentaries you can watch about, you know, health insurance and how small businesses, it's very expensive for them to buy health insurance as opposed to a large corporation. So if you have a business with like 50 employees, let's say one employee has a very complicated pregnancy, you know, which may cost $1 million, well, that means everybody else's premiums go up. Whereas if you have a corporation of 10,000, you know, you could have three or four people have that problem and it really would not affect that because there's so many other people there to offset the cost.
Right, insurance is a gamble when you think about it. An insurance company is gambling, this is the irony, the insurance company is gambling that you're gonna be healthy. You're actually gambling that you're gonna be sick at some point, right? Yeah. The only way you win is if you get sick, because then you've purchased insurance and they will, you know, basically subsidize your illness. But if you're healthy, the insurance company wins in the sense that you're paying premiums and you're not taking anything out. And so Obamacare was an attempt to expand Medicaid coverage of people who are less healthy, more at risk. Yeah. And the way you do that is you say, well, let's get these young people who aren't paying anything, who aren't insured, let's get them into the system. And the moral justification is, as well, those young people could get sick, and a lot, you know, if they do get sick, they're not covered and they're exposed. So it's not a terrible thing. Professor McDaniel has raised an analogy that a lot of people have used. It's like car insurance. Now, I don't think it's exactly like car insurance, but that's that's basically the analogy, right? So why is it that all these insurance companies and pharmaceutical companies went along with the Obamacare plan in the first instance when it was a shakeup of a system by which they were making bazillions of dollars? They agreed to because the Obama administration said, hey, we're getting these young, healthy people in.
Mandate, yeah.
Yeah, so with the mandate, mandating young people buy insurance, so you guys are going to be okay. And the insurance company said, hey, sounds good. Yeah. It hasn't quite worked out. I mean, it's a tricky thing, as Professor McDaniel says. You know, how do I get you guys, younger people, who are healthy, how do I get you to buy insurance? And they said, well, we'll if you don't buy insurance, you'll pay a fine or a penalty. Well, the problem has been we haven't found a sweet spot that will actually induce you to purchase insurance rather than pay the penalty. A lot of younger people are just saying, I'll just pay the fine and then, you know, paying it or not paying taxes or whatever it is that younger people do these days. And so the insurance companies haven't made money like they thought they would, or it hasn't been revenue neutral. So they're pulling out of some of the exchanges, as they call them, these state-run entities that are providing healthcare. So that's what's going on. So it's not like the administration, Obama administration's plan has been a roaring success, but they're still sort of tinkering with it. And to kind of ease the passage, they offered subsidies for companies. They haven't really enforced the mandate the way that they will in the future. They put off a lot of this stuff until after the 2016 election. Now it's kind of coming home to roost. But all the problems that the Affordable Care Act has had, they're there, but replacing it and taking away some of the things that the act did that people now like. People who have insurance on the cheap like it. People who have pre-existing injuries, parents who can keep their kids on their health care for a long till they're 26 years old. All of those things are attractive. So the Republicans are trying to figure out, well, how do we undo this thing without taking away the things that people like? And how do we, you know, if we continue to subsidize the things that people like, how do we do it without busting the budget?
Yeah, I mean, this is extreme. I mean, this is social policy. I mean, it's about redistributing of resources and how much do you redistribute. So if you think of the Obama administration and the way Obamacare was framed, is that health care is a right. So you have a right to this, so the government is obligated to provide you with this. Whereas others have said, no, it is a privilege. It is not a human right, but really a market piece. And so the idea is you earn the right to have this. And these kind of go back and forth about, okay, what exactly do you have a right to housing? Do you have a right to certain things? And what are certain things that are privileges? And so if we think of a right to education, if we think of a right to clean air, things of that nature, do we also have a right to health? And if we have a right to health, how do you carry that out? And many times when you're talking about social policies, this is about securing certain rights for individuals. And so we could argue that the elderly have a right to health. That's why we provide Medicare. We could also argue that the elderly have a right to have a certain level of living. That's why we have Social Security. And so when we talk about rights and then connect rights to policy, that's where things get very interesting. Because rights, we can talk about them all day until we're blue in the face in a very abstract sense. But when you actually put them into policy, that's when things get very different. And really, in order to carry these things out, you have to redistribute resources. And how do you know you're redistributing things fairly? While we're all supportive of taxing the rich, things of that nature, when are you overtaxing the rich? And what are you basically allowing some groups to not pay their fair share? So these are very important concerns. And when we talk about entitlement programs, that is where we see a lot of this coming into play. Well, if you really want to decrease the budget, decrease the entitlement programs. Medicare, Medicaid. You decrease those, you significantly decrease the budget. But those are kind of, you know, if you think about it, those are the third rail in politics. You don't mess with Social Security. You don't mess with Medicare. Because the elderly vote, the elderly are very active. Plus, most of us plan to be elderly. And so we want to make sure there's something there to care for us when we get there. And so it's one of these things that when you put it out there, people really clamp onto it. And the problem is sometimes you need to adjust it, but there are costs to making these adjustments. And we need to remember, this is not just some type of political game. People's lives are actually at stake here. And so we need to be aware of how are people's lives being affected by changes in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And while a lot of attention is being paid to the political game, we also need to pay attention to really the actual real people that are affected by this. And I think one of the reasons why you're seeing the support increase is because people are actually saying, oh, no, this actually does benefit me. And so you're seeing that at the ground level, you're seeing more support because people are beginning to see the benefits and in some cases being saying that the burdens that they see with it are not as great as the benefits.
All right, speaking of the political aspects of this, we're going to run a short clip from Morning Joe, which I think was, this ran Tuesday morning, talking about, and this was before Mitch McConnell postponed a vote on the Senate version. So let's take a look at Morning Joe and a bit of quick analysis on the political fallout from this Senate reconsideration of Obamacare.
Like he didn't.
Let's steal
he
his
didn't
words.
Tell the truth
Me.
On the campaign trail.
I know, like, you're shocked by that, but
somebody trying to sell you an apartment.
But this is one,
lying about this, like, the
windows
expenses.
That don't work.
This has the potential to be a defining moment in the Senate, because that vote on this bill, if there is a vote on this bill, is going to be a test of conscience and character for these senators.
Well, if by defining you mean any Republican who votes for it, and a swing state's going to lose for the rest of their life.
Former Treasury official and Morning Joe economic analyst Steve Rattner is with us.
If only we had somebody that could break down the numbers.
Exactly.
I'm going out looking for that person
if
during the break.
Only.
NBC News Capitol Hill correspondent Casey Hunt joins us as well. This morning, the CBO's assessment of the Senate health care plan is making it that much harder for Republicans to push it through. The nonpartisan group found that over the next decade, 22 million people fewer would be insured compared to Obamacare, and that deficit savings would largely come on the back of cuts in Medicaid spending, $772 billion. Of the 15 million people who would no longer be on Medicaid as a result of the law, the CBO forecast would not purchase private coverage, since the Senate bill would encourage them to purchase plans whose premiums and deductibles are too high or be attractive options to them. In the end, the plan would reduce the deficit by about $320 billion. At first, the CBO estimates premiums would go up, but by 2026, premiums could be 20% lower compared to Obamacare. Still, that doesn't account for reductions in coverage for out-of-pocket costs.
Well, you can tell Mika Brzezinski is not a big fan of the Senate version of the bill, but you see kind of the different aspects of the debate. What you've basically done with the Affordable Care Act is you've extended Medicaid. And that wasn't how it was sold. That wasn't how it was debated. It was debated as, you know, hey, if you like your health care, you can keep it. It turned out that really was a fairly significant expansion of health insurance, providing it to a range of people who couldn't afford it before, expansion of Medicaid. And then additional people were basically told, like, hey, you need to purchase it. It's the mandate, the younger people. And so that 22 million is an important number. But Professor McDaniel and I were just talking about the fact that, you know, there's, what is it now, 370 million Americans, I think?
Yeah, I mean, the number of Americans, and this is what makes it very difficult, is that the number of Americans who are actually affected by not having insurance is pretty small. Most Americans receive their insurance from their employer, and one of the arguments for why the American healthcare system is so wonky and kind of messy, as opposed to maybe the retirement system, is that with the retirement system, the government led first with Social Security, then the companies followed suit. With health insurance, the companies started, and they had all kinds of convoluted ways of doing it, and then the government came in to try to fill the cracks, and it's just kind of a hot mess. But for the most part, people are covered by the private employer. And so many people who are in this fight really are arguing this along ideological grounds, not necessarily self-interest. So it's either you believe, you know, healthcare should be expanded to more people and you're willing to sacrifice for that, or you believe that, no, healthcare is not a right, or the way it's being expanded is too much of a burden on me. And so it's very important to understand that this fight about healthcare and people's discussion of it is, most people don't really have to worry about this. There's a certain portion of the population that we need to be concerned about. And again, they're not as well represented as we would say these other groups are.
It's an important point. I mean, I think the number initially in 2010, when the Affordable Care Act was first being debated, the number of uninsured. And so we're not talking, by the way, if you need health care in the United States, you will get health care. I mean, you know, if you're bleeding, someone will take you to an emergency room. So it's not a matter of health care, it's a matter of health insurance, which is a a related but important issue.
All about financing.
Right. And I think the number was something like 40 million Americans did not have, 40 to 50 million Americans did not have health insurance in the United States. What Obamacare has done is that it's reduced that number by about 40%. Right. And so they're talking, when these figures on Morning Joe or whatever, they're talking about 20, 22 million Americans would lose it. These are people who did not have it prior to 2010, but are now covered because of this expansion of Medicaid and because of the individual mandate. Right. And so, you know, we want to put that in perspective. It's not that that's not obviously a very significant number of people, but as with respect to the entirety of the United States, it's not like, you know, one out of three or something like that. It's an important debate, but it needs a little bit of context. I did want to just mention that Joe Scarborough in that clip had sort of a throwaway line where he said basically any Republican in a swing state, you know, who votes for the Senate bill will lose forever. This is the conventional wisdom in Washington that any Republicans who take a very difficult vote in favor of the House bill, or in particular the Senate bill, are going to put themselves at political risk in the next election cycle and probably the election cycle after that and after that. It's going to be a very difficult vote to justify in the next elections. That's the conventional wisdom in Washington. And I just want to use that as a quick segue. We don't want to spend a ton of time on the 2018 elections. But I did want to point out that, you know, this is consequential. The Republicans are the majority party in both the House and the Senate. I just was looking this up because we keep having these special elections that fill different seats. Right now, the Republican majority in the House is 241 Republicans, 193 Democrats with one vacancy. Okay, so the Republican majority is, 41 plus 7? 48 seats. So there has to be a swing of 25 in order to give the Democrats the House. So the Democrats have to take 25 seats away from Republicans. Is that possible in 2018? Yeah, it absolutely is possible. It's tough. We haven't had many swings of that magnitude. However, we have had quite a few recently. In 2006, the Democrats picked up more than 25 seats and retook the House in the second part of the second half of the Bush's second term. In 2010, the Republicans had a swing of like 47 seats. Yep. And took over the House in 2010.
Part of that was reaction to Obamacare.
Right, right. And so you notice, by the way, there's a pattern here, right? Incumbent president, right, his party loses seats in midterm elections. That's been a consistent, not inviolable, but a consistent pattern in American politics over time. There have only been three times, I think, where the president's party did not lose seats in the next midterm. One was 1998, the second Clinton term. One was 2002, which is the first Bush term, but it was after 9/11. Yeah. And in fact, Bush didn't even win the popular vote in 2000. So, you know, he didn't exactly have some supermajority that he was losing from, right? And so it's happened recently that the president has managed to insulate himself from this loss. But it's more common than not. So 2006, Bush loses seats. 2010, Obama loses seats. 2014, Obama loses more seats. Yep. So our expectation heading into 2018, because the Republicans have a large majority, there are a lot of seats that Republicans are winning where there is kind of a Democratic, at least not a Democratic majority, then certainly a competitive Democratic presence in the district. And Democrats are targeting those seats. We call this, by the way, the phenomenon of the president losing seats in the next midterm election, we refer to as surge and decline, where the surge refers to the influx of the president's party's supporters coming in for the presidential election. The decline is that they either switch their votes or they don't show up in the next midterm. And there's a very kind of long and boring, I actually found it sort of interesting, but you all probably wouldn't be that interested in it, debate about whether it's persuasion that's more important. That is it that people who voted for the president just get disillusioned and they vote the other way? Or is it that they get fat and happy and they don't turn out? So it's a persuasion versus a mobilization explanation, or I guess it would be a demobilization explanation, for the surge in the presidential and then the decline in the midterm election. But we assume, now it's kind of curious for 2018 though, because Trump lost the popular vote. So there wasn't a huge surge for Trump. In that sense, we don't expect as much of a decline. On the other hand, the Republicans are kind of an overbuilt congressional party right now. They hold a lot of seats the demographics and underlying partisan predispositions would suggest they're not really very strong Republican seats. And so the Republicans are at risk to lose these seats. What factors play into surge and decline? Presidential popularity. Right now, the president is not very popular. He's at about 40% approval. Presidents at 40% approval are ripe for a decline in the midterm election. The economy matters. That's pushing in the other direction. The economy is moving along pretty well right now. That might help the Republicans in 2018. So the magic number is 25 seats in the House. The Republicans only have 53 seats out of 100 in the Senate. So the Democrats have to pick up 4 seats. 50-50, Mike Pence breaks ties in favor of the Republicans. So the Democrats need 51 seats. Can they get those seats? It's very difficult because the class of 2018, remember from our lessons about the Constitution, when was the Senate class of 2018 elected most recently? 2012. What do we remember about the 2012 election? That was a pretty good election for Democrats. So the Democratic class of 2012 is up for re-election in 2018 now in the Senate. The Democrats, I believe, and I could be off a couple on this, but I believe the Democrats have 22 seats that they are defending in the Senate class of 2018. The Republicans are only defending, I think, 11. So the Democrats have more seats at risk than the Republicans. And that's, so mathematically you'd say, well, the Senate's much easier. The Democrats only need to pick up 4 seats.
But there are only really 11.
But there aren't many targets.
Yeah.
There aren't many targets. I guess the most prominent target is probably Nevada. So one thing, you know, those of you who are really interested in this, watch the senator from Nevada, Heller, I think his name is. Watch his vote on repeal and replace Obamacare, because that's an individual who's probably pretty vulnerable. But he's one of the few. Otherwise, the Republicans are basically defending safe seats, states in very Republican states, like Texas, for instance. Ted Cruz is up for re-election. There aren't a lot of people, I'm sorry to my Beto O'Rourke fans out there, there aren't a lot of people who think that Beto is going to take down Ted. You know, could happen, but it would probably take something going on, you know, some sort of murder or
maybe that.
But anyway, the Senate actually looks to be less of a target than the House, even though the Republican majority is much weaker in the Senate than the House.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's important to note when we're talking about, like, what may hurt the Republicans, these are some funny things to realize. If there is a natural disaster near the election, incumbents fare worse. Now, again, they had nothing to do with it, but it fares worse. There's also evidence that if your football team is in the top 25 and it gets upset the weekend before the election, incumbents are in danger. So one of the things we realize is that when people go to the voting booth, incumbents are blamed for anything and everything that goes wrong in people's lives. But one thing that's also important to remember is that the press, when they talk about this, is going to run around like Chicken Little, the sky is falling. This happens almost all the time. All right, so again, CNN with its breaking news, sun rises in the east. This rear wheel check for consistency. Again.
Hashtag sad.
Yes.
Failing CNN.
I mean, so again, make sure you're able to kind of get through all the drama and get to what's at the heart of it. And that's why I stress the idea of, like, don't just focus on the politics and the maneuvering and things like that. Also pay attention to the policy, because that's really what's at the heart of the matter. Not so much the drama, but the policy that's at the heart of it. And again, the media has to be overdramatic, because you don't watch it unless it's dramatic. So. Yep.
Media news is by definition what's new. Yeah. A couple other stories. We don't want to keep you long, so we'll probably go fairly short on these. But speaking of CNN and the media, there's been a dust up this week. And Professor McDaniel, I want to give you the big picture view. But the little picture is that CNN is once again in a fight with the Trump administration. Apparently, a CNN producer was caught on tape agreeing with the notion that CNN's interest in the Russia investigation is mostly because of ratings and that there's really nothing there. I would encourage you to take a look at that tape on yourself. I think it's a little more complicated than that. I don't think the producer was kind of admitting some of the things he's been accused of admitting. You know, I don't think this is a fake news story, and I don't think that's what he was implying. But he was very kind of forthright about how the Russia story is good for CNN's ratings. And so they are focusing on that. And, of course, the White House picked up on this. There is a new White House press secretary. Suzanne Huckabee.
Huckabee.
So it's former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee's wife.
Daughter,
is the new White House press secretary, although I think that's temporary, replacing Sean Spicer of Saturday Night Live fame. And she's been aggressive, pushing back at some of these news stories, and the president, of course, continues to tweet about them. There was another CNN kind of aspect to this CNN story, and several people have been fired over this. There was an investigation, again, of a potential Trump connection with Russia that turned out to be kind of a hoax. And CNN, I don't know that CNN went with the story, but they kind of were aggressively investigating the story. And so CNN's kind of taken it on the chin a little bit this week, although it's not clear to me it'll hurt their ratings very much. We just want to point out that there continues to be this tension. And it's not just Trump. The Bush administration had a very tendentious relationship
Dan
with the press.
Rather's career ended.
That's right. Dan Rather, former, you know, heavyweight in broadcasting, came a cropper on a fake news story with respect to George W. Bush. The Obama administration was notoriously prickly and contemptuous of the mainstream news. They thought they were a dinosaur and they didn't really need them and that they were kind of beneath them. And so that trajectory, this sort of downhill relationship between particularly the president and the press, this is simply, and maybe it's accelerated or decelerated a little, but it's something you all as consumers of news and as citizens ought to watch because it's getting pretty nasty. And
pretty nasty pretty early.
Yeah, and the fact that, you know, the White House in particular is calling into question whether this whole notion of fake news, you know, it's not we don't like your spin, we don't like your interpretation. We're calling it fake, and that's, as you said, that's a de-escalation, an acceleration of this trend, and it's not good. We also wanted to mention the Supreme Court ended its session this week.
Yeah, so I would advise you to go take a look at some of the decisions the Supreme Court has made. But one of the big things is that it upheld parts of President Trump's travel ban or travel restrictions. Travel restrictions. It upheld certain parts of it, but stated that it will review the other parts. So this is seen as a victory for the Trump administration and the fact that the Supreme Court upheld parts of these restrictions. However, the Supreme Court will revisit it and will be interested to see how they look at the case as things go on.
Yep. I got nothing much on that. I think there's been a little bit of an overplaying of what the Supreme Court basically says. One, we'll take the case. That was what they really said. We're going to decide on, you know, basically this broader question of the president's right to craft immigration policy, to execute the immigration policies of the United States as defined by the Constitution and by federal statute, right? We're going to take that in the fall. In the meantime, they unlocked some of the bans that the lower courts had placed, the appellate courts had placed on President Trump's executive orders. They didn't unlock all of them. They had some kind of curious things. They basically said that you know, people who have, what was it, a direct and close familial or...
I think stepsisters can come, grandmas cannot.
Yeah, they basically said you need a close connection to justify being allowed into the United States. But they didn't define what that close connection was, and it was sort of odd. But at any rate, they'll presumably, you know, articulate a clearer, more forceful sort of interpretation in the fall. You know, but that was one case that was interesting. They agreed to take a couple of LGBT cases that are going to come up in the fall. So the next session, which will begin in October, the first one with all nine of the justices, including Gorsuch, is going to be pretty interesting. And then last thing we just want to close on, you guys might have noticed this if you read the newspaper or saw the Statesman or anything online this week, but there's been a lot of rallies, protests where local governments, advocates of local government and local control have taken aim at state legislation that has targeted state and local governments for kind of reprisals. And in particular, it revolves around the issue of sanctuary cities.
Yeah, I think that is also on the court's docket or certain aspects of it.
Yep.
And that's gonna be really a continuing thing. So it's not just the sanctuary cities, but remember we talked about Uber and Lyft. And one of the things that's very important to understand when we're talking about politics, and we're talking about the way things get passed, is sometimes you look for certain venues. You do venue shopping. And so Uber and Lyft were trying to work at the city level, but they lost in Austin, they lost in Houston. And so what they did is they found, like, oh, there might be something open for us at the state level. And so they moved from activities at the local level to the state level. They found an open a venue that could work with them there. And when we're looking at various groups and how they try to defend their interests, they look for certain venues. So if you think about Professor Shaw's lecture about social movements and really the civil rights movement, you know, there's venue shopping there. First, you start off with the legal aspects. So you start, you know, you start working through the courts as a venue. Then, you know, think of the political action. I mean, that is another venue in which to do these things. And so it's very important to understand that just because you stop something in one place does not mean you stop it someplace else. And so if they lose in spot A, they may try to go to spot B. And in many ways, you know, by moving from the local level to the state level, they basically fixed the problem in Texas. Yeah. And so they'll probably be actively lobbying other state legislatures to work with them. And they find that those state legislatures are not friendly towards them, they may move to the cities.
One interesting thing that dovetails with something that Professor McDaniel and I talk about in our lecture about Texas and reforming Texas is that, you know, Texas by design has limited what we call the ordinance power of local governments and municipal governments. In a lot of other states, I come from California, and in California, San Diego, Los Angeles, Riverside, San Francisco, these municipal, local and municipal governments have a lot of power. They can determine, say, smoking ordinances or noise ordinances or things like that. In Texas, local and municipal governments have those rights, but they're really restricted and they're really kind of governed by state law. And one of the things that people, you know, who really study these things and study, you know, kind of levels of government have suggested is that Texas would do well if they would empower their states and localities to take care of a lot of these sort of local issues with local ordinances. But that's not the way the state's set up right now. And that lack of power, or I should say the oversight power and the overriding power of the state government comes into play when the state government basically says, hey, we don't want you to do certain things, right? We don't want sanctuary cities. We don't want Uber and Lyft operating, you know, without these things come into play. And, you know, the reaction that you're seeing, driven by policy preferences, it's not like the people who are protesting are necessarily inherent believers in local government. They simply think the local government's more likely to give them what they want here.
Yeah.
And hey, I got no problem with that. That's, you know, as Professor McDaniel said, you go with the horse, you know, that's going to deliver for you. And so I don't think this is a theoretical argument where, you know, by gum, states and localities ought to have more power than the state. I think it's an argument that we don't like what the state is doing. We should let the local governments decide. And by the way, both sides, left and right, do this, right? You know, you think of the Republicans as the local government party, the limited government. They are until that local government doesn't want to do what they would like to do.
Yeah, and then the Democrats became the states' rights party when it came to LGBT issues because they realized they couldn't win at the national level. But they became the states' rights party there. Yeah. Again, it's all about where you think you're going to win. And where you think you're going to win is where you want to have the battle.
At any rate, I think that's it for this week. And I guess that's our last In the News lecture. So make sure you guys get your In the News responses in on time. Take care of your web text business. And we'll see you in office hours or sometime beyond.
All right.
Have a good weekend.
The Government 310 In the News podcast is hosted by Drs. Darren Shaw and Eric McDaniel and is produced by the Liberal Arts ITS Development Studio and the Department of Government in the College of Liberal Arts at the University of Texas at Austin.